Project next. Uncovering the trends that are shaping our future.
Hello, darlings. Well, how wonderful it is to be back here at KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. How are you, darlings? I want to thank everybody who showed up for KPFK Pacifica for this tentacles of love and empowerment and just letting you know that you're not alone and that it has value to you, that you take those hard-earned dollars and give them to us and look what we're able to do with them. So, fantastic transition now into regularly scheduled programming, and there is no other way and opportunity to come back into our shared knowingness than to welcome back in one of our very original genies, the first man that I had on the program way back when. What was that, in like 2000 2001? It's been some time. We're going to be spending and reconnecting and ionizing with Bob Dobbs tonight here live on KPFK. And we're also going to be, bringing on some of that sweet substance of ion, because all the clarion calls for your activation, your activity, for you to get your gluteus maximus is in gear. Oh, well, we don't have to be aggro or angry about it. There's something about beauty. There's something about love that makes us face down this this slaughter, this ridiculous stuff, such as Syria and everything. And I really hope you guys are going out there and letting your voice be heard on this material plane, taking care of your chemical bodies, because they are, seriously under assault. But we hope that you still use that old form of activation and activity, and are really speaking out against this Syrian war. It is so important to just flood, to just call, and to get on Facebook, to get on Twitter, and to talk this down, and to put a whole different spin and spirit on this thing that is happening there. It's going to collapse the economies. Oil's already at $110 a barrel. Prices now are at like $3.96 per gallon. Watch that go to $5. Watch that go to $5.50. Once again, it is just a complete manipulation. And that's trying to get to all four of your bodies and your spiritual body. But there's one thing about you that is so powerful. It is something of beauty. It is something that has such an amazing force itself that you have access to. And it's called love. And on the lines, Bob Dobbs has been exploring. There is no crevice, I don't think, Bob has not uncovered in the years that he has been working with ION. And we have a very special treat tonight, in that a lot of people that have had private sessions with ION are making their sessions available, and we are picking up part of some of these private sessions are being released on a website called informationfarm.blogspot.com. Without further ado, let me welcome Bob Dobbs back into Los Angeles through this great technological device called radio. Bob, how are you, sir?
Hey, Evan. It's a pleasure to be Los Angeles again.
Yes.
And it was 13 and a half years ago, March 2000, when I inaugurated your Radio Alchemy with a explanation of media ecology, and there's something I want to say about that later, the theme of media ecology, but let's go into what you want to talk about, whatever it is right now.
Well, you know what? There is something, Bob, that obviously is missing from the body politic in our way of trying to respond to all of this information, all of these compartments, all of our bodies, all working simultaneously in this mania that we're in. And part of that, I just want to talk with you about this too, because in your forays in talking with ION, et cetera, obviously you are trying, what ION says and what you're bringing seems to be the complete opposite from the angst that people want to expound against what we see happening in front of our eyes. How would you put it in a nutshell, how your perspective would instruct someone to deal with what is happening in the world today?
I understand we're not allowed to talk about products on...
Oh, yeah, not products, but I'm talking about just the architecture. That's something that pushes the button. The RNA drops and stuff like that pushes a button, but it pushes a particular architecture. It pushes, you know, I want you to go more into just what you know the body is capable of doing with or, you know, without, you know, RNA drops and things like that.
Well, what's unique is we learned from Ion that the body is pretty incapable of dealing with the stresses because it's fragmented into, extended into four or five levels now, four or five bodies. And this is unprecedented. No system is an antidote to this. And after I did thousands of hours with Ion from 2009 to 2010, you know, almost 2 years, a lot of information we put out on AchieveRadio.com and on your show and everywhere's. And it was profound what Ion was saying, but in the end it was just another voice talking on the ethers. So Ion came up with a product, and that was phase two, and that relaxes your being, creates new cells, and makes you get into a state of poise, which is what people ultimately are looking for now, because the stress is too much, the stress is obvious, the causes are, there's all kinds of reasons for the causes that are become memes and religions and protest groups, but it doesn't get people out of the stress of that. So, if I don't know how you talk about it, I can't talk about the RNA drops, it's a product, but that is phase two of information overload. It's the effect of RNA drops, which is absolutely astounding. If we were on a commercial station now, I'd be able to give you 100 hours of testimonies that are unbelievable. So, okay, so let's step back from that. That's the solution, but we had to talk about that. So we'll step back to the information world, and what I began with 13 and a half years ago with the discipline of media ecology. Now, this was popularized by Marshall McLuhan. And right around that time, 2000, some academics out of Fordham University in New York City formed an academic professional, whatever they call themselves, organization called the Media Ecology Association. So I've been watching them for 13 or more years, and I wanted to see if they got to the hidden motherlode of it all. Because they're supposed to be scholars, and they're supposed to find out who did what and how it got to here and what are they promoting and who do they recommend now. So they focused on people like Neil Postman, Jackie Liu, who's that? Walter Ong. If you go to their website, Media Ecology Association, you will see about 10 people. Suzanne Langer is another one. And I waited for them to find the secret route. And the secret roots are a man named Wyndham Lewis, who's the most lamb-based, smeared artist of the modernist period. There was a documentary on British art a couple of years ago in London, and they went a little bit into Wyndham Lewis, and they said he was one of the most evil men of the 20th century, and as they said it, they held up his brain, which was preserved by doctors. It's sort of like a takeoff on Hitler's brain.
Wow.
And so many people have never heard of Wyndham Lewis. But here's Wyndham Lewis. A quick synopsis. Why is he very important? Because the dialectic today, or at least up till Y2K in 2000, was 1984, who had it right, George Orwell or Marshall McLuhan? Both of them wrote extensively in 1984 and apparently had very different views on how to approach it, and how to deal with this Leviathan known as 1984 or non-Leviathan. Remember the famous Apple computer in January 84 at the Super Bowl where the woman comes in, the athlete, and smashes the Big Brother icon. That was the symbolism of the decentralization that the Apple computer was going to bring in. You've heard of that.
Yes.
Commercial, right? So
yes.
You would see that Apple would be on McLuhan's side, up against the top-down Noam Chomsky's Orwellian 1984. Well, guess who inspired both visions, both artistic works? Wyndham Lewis. It was Wyndham Lewis that got George Orwell thinking about media in the 30s, and he wrote a letter and a couple anecdotes of him saying this to some colleagues, that he goes, well, maybe Wyndham Lewis is right. And he started to consider what Lewis was saying, which was very odd and out of the box back then in the 20s and 30s. And he was inspired by looking at Lewis to start to create the vision of 1984. All right? Meanwhile, Marshall McLuhan meets Wyndham Lewis in Toronto or Detroit area in 1943 and gets inspired by Lewis's vision and goes on to create his work, which leads to media ecology. So you have two major icons, Orwell and McLuhan, coming out of Wyndham Lewis. Now, no one's ever going to tell you that, Eben. No one, other than the Wyndham Lewis Society over there in England, their professors, baby boomer professors, who started to reassess Wyndham Lewis in the 70s and 80s. And they've built up a great journal, Journal of Wyndham Lewis Studies. I don't know if that's a product, but if you want to see the best, most interesting avant-garde writing about a person who has such a bad image, get the Journal of Wyndham Lewis Studies. So the professors there, Paul Edwards, Alan Munton, they do great work excavating this stuff. Alan Munton found the Orwell communication about Lewis. So here's this guy you never heard of. So what does he say? What's his political position? His political position is written in 1929 in a magazine that Wyndham Lewis put out in London. Now, Wyndham Lewis is celebrated by David Bowie and Captain Beefheart. They see him as the original cyberpunk. And the guy who sings for The Fall, can't remember, was Marky Smith or something. You know that name? The Fall, the band The Fall?
The Fall, but I don't know the lead singer, though.
Yeah, it's Marky Smith or something like that. I can
Right.
look it up. But anyway, so these guys tuned into Lewis in the late 70s, early 80s, and they thought he was a pretty unique icon for how the world was unfolding in the 80s. So in 1929, he put out a journal called The Enemy. And he had an artistic theory that the artist was the real king, and the king was the enemy of the people. He was supposed to be an anti-environment to the sleepy, wonderful world that the community had created. And the king would go around stirring up crap. Remember the scene in, what is it, The Holy Grail, where these two people are arguing in the mud, must be about 1000 A.D., these peasants, and the king comes along with a horse made of coconut rattlings. and he was a king. And, of course, he had no community yet or something, and the anarchists who were arguing in the mud were just told him to go buzz off. But anyways, this was the king going around looking for a community. So Lewis set himself up as the new avant-garde artist king, one-man army. And here's what he said in 1929. He's asking people for the moment to deal with media dynamics and not your political views. But before he does that, he tells us his political views. And what are they, Mr. Lewis? Well, mine are partly communist and partly fascist, with a distinct streak of monarchism in my Marxism, but at bottom, an anarchist with a healthy passion for order. Now, did you get that?
That's awesome!
That is you. That is everybody on the planet today. Because you got four bodies, you got to juggle so many different things, and you're in so many different environments, including just think of your experience at a local airport. You're up against, hardware communists, software communists, hardware fascists, monarchists, anarchists, religionists, all these things. And we all learn these with the internet. We learn all about these memes. It's easy to find out about them. So we are very informed today, super informed people all over the planet. And so, being super informed, we actually live a life of, on Tuesdays I'm a communist, on Thursdays I'm a fascist, on Friday I'm a monarchist, and on Saturday I'm an anarchist. All right? And then on Sunday, what do? Oh, I go get a sweat lodge, don't I? Yeah, I take some herbs, maybe get some, talk to Dr. Dean, about magnesium. Oh, back on Tuesday, I'm a fascist again in my job. Somebody's hassling me on the highway to the airport, and I just get mean. If you look at it, if we're honest about ourselves, these old political categories do not hold anybody singularly. We move through them as echoes of all this social organization in a time of chaos in society and anarchy. So repeat, I declare myself a quadriphenic, and Wyndham Lewis laid down the pattern for the 21st century. I'm partly communist, partly fascist. I got a distinct streak of monarchism and Marxism, and I'm a bottom an anarchist, so a healthy passion for order. Now, I say that this is the situation that you're asking me about. How do you be a quadriphenic and related to particular issues? Well, Hugh Kenner was a famous student of Macomb, became a famous American critic. And he decided that Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce and T.S. Eliot and W.B. Yeats and Ezra Pound were the great avant-garde radical modernist poets and writers of the day and very significant, influenced culture all over the first half of the 20th century. But he decided that Ezra Pound was the catalyst of it. He was a significant go-to guy and helped a lot of people. So he wrote a book in 1971 called The Pound Era, all right, about that period up till, say, 1960, which I would call the period of analog media, analog electric media. And these guys, Pound, Lewis, Joyce, Eliot, and Yeats were trying to create art and poetry and novels and paintings and sculptures in response to this new electronic world. All right. Well, Don Thiel was the next very smart student of Marsh McLuhan, actually Marsh McLuhan's first PhD. So he decided to counter Hugh Kenner with a book 25 years later called The Joyce Era. And he said James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake was more appropriate to understanding the digital world we were getting into in the 1990s, which I've popularized calling it the Android meme. This excessive, incredible utopia of information that one could engage in or get very depressed from, Ezra Pound's Cantos, this famous epic poem, did not meet the needs of that era in the 90s. More Finnegan's Wake, the synesthesia of beginning to have four bodies, was more appropriate. So Don Thiel declared it the Joyce era. And I would agree with that from 1960 to 2000, the digital era as it grew. We're now in a new world where the digital era is so tiny, little kids can run their own editing, music, movies, TVs, websites, Facebooks. They're not dominated by media in any way. All right? They are actually exploring it way beyond older people understand. So they're in their power with the post-digital Android meme, which I call the renewed anthropomorphic physical. What human beings are, that they project into society or into the world something of themselves that distinguishes them from everybody else, is an anthropomorphic vision. Also, it's a fantasy that nature is like us. So we'll call it the AP, the anthropomorphic physical. Well, how do you speak when I can interact with millions of people with my chip body, and I can do a lot of spiritual stuff with my astral body, and I can do a lot of drugs with my chemical body, and I can do what's left? The TV body, I can go on
you can travel.
.ag. And did you just yell?
No. You just said that, and I just remember you talking about how television, you travel through it.
Yes, well, television is a TV body now. It's been shrunk. But you go to primewire.ag, PrimeWire.ag, and you can get every television show that ever happened for free. You don't have to put up with Hulu commercials, Netflix charges. It's all there. It's the most incredible station, everything you ever saw. And new movies are on there within 5 minutes. Somebody might be eating popcorn over them, but within a week they put a better quality out. But anyways, you got this utopia of TV reality of every show that ever happened, so you can explore that. So all these bodies. And it's all your servant. So you are in charge of the media, of your media experience and your multi-body experience. And so I'm thinking that actually Wyndham Lewis, the way he wrote, he created a new kind of political spy fiction in the 30s. He did all kinds of incredible writings. And he wrote over 50 books, hundreds of thousands of paintings, also was a critic on BBC. And he's also, the way his life went, he's so symptomatic of our celebrity culture. He was the first. He was famous. And then he made a mistake. He went over and actually did an article on Hitler when nobody cared about Hitler, 1930-31. And he did this book, and then everybody thought, and then later Hitler turned out to be a monster. Meanwhile, Wyndham Lewis denounced Hitler, but they went back to what he wrote in the 31. They said, this guy's a promoter of Hitler. And you can actually, if you can find this book, it's very rare, it's advertised as a Nazi publication. But no, it was published by a respectable English publisher, Chatto & Windus. Anyways, it's like any scandal anybody gets, it's a Miley Cyrus, whatever his name is, twerking a problem for her image. So Lewis was scandalized, and they wouldn't even allow his fantastic portraits of his famous friends in the, whatever the museum was, the main one back there in 1930. So he had to leave London during World War II, and he did a lot of great stuff in Canada and the United States in that period. But he goes back. And he gets rehabilitated by the young artists like Francis Bacon and all these new guys. They realize Lewis was the best and most powerful guy coming out of that pre-war period. So he got back on the BBC. He became a critic, art critic for The Listener. And he had his new trilogy, The Human Age, made as a radio broadcast on BBC. The point is, he went like you did, Eben. You're in and then you're out. And then you're a doghouse. Then you're back in. Then everybody wants to work with you. And then they think you're an asshole. All goes up and down in his media profile, right? Well, Lewis
yes.
was the archetype of that. He went down to the bottom and he was brought back. But he didn't care. He kept on working. And his last 5 years of his life, he passed in 1957, he wrote three or four books while blind. Wow. This guy was a volcano. So I'm now on a mission. I agree with the Wyndham Lewis Group, the Journal of Wyndham Lewis Studies. James Joyce, he had it okay for the 20th century, but we gotta look at Wyndham Lewis. He didn't hide out and write a complex work. He didn't drop out like Ezra Pound, who went over to Italy and started being on the radio for Mussolini. Lewis stayed in the trenches, was there. He was one of the first guys on television before World War II. He did everything and kept doing it. And so he's a model of you, Eben, the way you work. You're involved in everything. You're in school, you're not in school, you're over here, you're posting, publishing, promoting. You are quadriphenic. And I think the fact that Lewis stayed active, he didn't get distracted in some aesthetic project, as good as they were, by Pound, Joyce, and Eliot. He stayed in the trenches and remained activist, and he inspired two people who become the main thinkers of the second half of the 20th century. So, I say Wyndham Lewis is the man, and you don't see him mentioned on the Media College Association's masthead. So what should we do? Well, you go to Sheila Watson, the first postmodern female novelist in Canada, put out a great book, taught all over the world, called Double Hook in, I think, 1959 or so. She wrote, under McLuhan's guidance, the most incredible document. It's a PhD on Wyndham Lewis called Wyndham Lewis and Expressionism, which was an art form coming out of Germany competing with Cubism and Vorticism in the, you know, in the teens last century. Her thesis is so incredible of knowledge to understand that period and the beginnings of media ecology as laid out by Wyndham Lewis. So I waited for 13 years to see if these boys over at the Media Ecology Association even heard of Sheila Watson. They may have heard of her, but they didn't realize what she did. Then parallel to that is a friend of Sheila Watson. I already mentioned him, Don Thiel, who later does the book The Joyce Era. His PhD in 1954, Sheila Watson was 1965. Don Thiel's 1954, he's the first PhD under McLuhan. His thesis is called Communication Theories in Modern Poetry. It's about Yeats, Pound, Eliot, and Joyce. That thesis is a great complement to Sheila Watson's thesis because they tell you what Marsh McLuhan taught in his courses and what he had to say. And I would like to read an excerpt from it.
Yes.
Unless you have something to say at this point.
No, keep going.
All right. So this is page 220 of the printout, the original type manuscript of Don Thiel, T-H-E-A-L-L, T-H-E-A-L-L, his PhD on the communication theories, which was a new term by Marshall McLuhan. They were the first guys up in Toronto to actually talk about communication theories. The Macy conferences were happening, cybernetics, but nobody knew about them. That was all secret. So here is Don Thiel in 1952, 53, 54. He's just in his early 20s. Writing about poetry and social communication. So what relevance has poetry got to Syria or to what we are asking about? Don writes, "The most important discovery, as T.S. Eliot has often reiterated, is the discovery of a new rhythm. For new rhythms lead to a subtleization of the societal techniques for transferring attitudes and feelings. The process of discovery, invention and creation, has a distinct influence on language and as such has a bearing ultimately on the language as spoken." So you see, Don is talking about new rhythms, which become, for McLuhan, new technologies create new environmental rhythms and have massive effects. Just think of Elvis is going to come in, show up in 2 years after this is written. You're going to have him with a new rhythm in a new medium, radio for kids, and a new kind of poetry. So here's Don saying, "T.S. Eliot has been quite concerned with what occurs in cultural context, and it suggested on occasions that there is a continual interaction between the lower and higher strata of a society. The recognition, however, of such strata is of central importance to the health and well-being of the group." So we're going to think about KPFK and WBAI limping along, and then the Bilderbergers, all right? Let's suppose these two people, these two groups. Okay, so what he writes, he's quoting T.S. Eliot from an essay in 1943 called Notes Towards a Definition of Culture. And so here's what Eliot says. Trying to figure out what this obscure poetry that he and his buddies, the vorticists, write. I call Joyce, Eliot, Yeats, and Pound, and Lewis vorticists because they're all inspired by what Lewis was developing. He wrote the first avant-garde play in 1915 called Enemy of the Stars. Now think of that. Think of TMX or any of this stuff that goes on in the media the last 30, 40 years. The National Choir Syndrome. Yeah, they're all enemies of the stars. Well, that was the first play that Lewis wrote. 1915. And it's about the media society. So anyways, it inspired Joyce's Ulysses and everybody back then. So here is T.S. Eliot writing about what to do about this obscure poetry I'm making and society and what's happening in 1943, in the middle of World War II, getting ready for the atomic bomb. He says, "What is important is a structure of society in which there will be, from top to bottom, a continuous gradation of cultural levels. It is important to remember that we should not consider the upper levels as possessing more culture than the lower, but as representing a more conscious culture and a greater specialization of culture." Now, this is before TV, all right, so it's a totally different situation now. But anyways, "I incline to believe that no true democracy can maintain itself unless it contains these different levels of culture." So that's the quote that Don Thiel makes from T.S. Eliot, and then Don comes in to elaborate on it, and he says, "In such a society, the structure provides a peculiar case in which the way up and the way down mutually interact. The more conscious, higher-level elite often employ the perceptions of lower cultural levels in their work." Now, they employ, like jazz was coming in at that time. "At the same time, these perceptions fused into a new whole," at the same time, "these perceptions that are fused into a new whole are gradually disseminated down through the cultural chain." All right, that's the Gutenberg book world, and the elite poets start to filter down to the educational system. "In this case, there is a cultural interpretation as well to the way up and the way down, interpretation of what it is to go up and what it is to go down. In this situation, however, the communication channels between the various members of the high-level group is of utmost importance for healthy society." So now Eliot's going to concentrate on what the Bilderbergers do among themselves. "The existence at this level of segmentation or monopolies of knowledge that they apparently have that restrict other members of the same group, if you do that, it's dangerous to the health of the social structure." So Eliot and Don Thiel talk about the communication channels between the various members of the high-level group. "The type of communication that takes place between the various members of this high-level group is neither factual nor formal in nature. These are only minor aspects of it. Now, the organization of committees or the formation of societies, secret societies, whatever, intelligence agencies, does not overcome the problem of making sure that the higher and lower level society are interacting their contributions of culture." So here we go back to Eliot, goes into this. So think of this as the Bilderbergers, Trilateral Commission, or the recent mayor of San Diego. The elite and his buddies, right? Okay. "The elite should be something different, something much more organically composed than a panel of bozos, caciques, and tycoons." All right? So Eliot is saying there's something wrong with the prior scion and how they go about. And he says, "Men who meet only for definite serious purposes and on official occasions do not wholly meet. They may have some common concern, very much